This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the computer world, some people see Bill Gates as a visionary, some people see him as a ruthless businessman, and some see him as both. Gates is the co-founder and CEO of the world's most successful software company, Microsoft. Gates' personal fame has increased through the hoopla surrounding the recent release of Microsoft's new operating system, Windows 95, and the publication of Gates' new book, The Road Ahead. Stephen Manis is the co-author of a book about how Gates transformed the computer industry and made his fortune. It's called Gates. I asked Manis what he thinks are Bill Gates' greatest contributions to the computer world.
Well, I think Bill Gates' greatest contribution overall historically will be that he got people into the mind frame of paying for software. His greatest contributions are going to be business-wise, not technology-wise.
What do you mean he got people to pay for software?
Well, way back when this whole business started, it was pretty much a hobbyist business. I mean, this was a business for guys who had soldering irons and built their own computers. And those guys were doing it for fun. And their notion was software was the same way. You'd write it, you'd disseminate it, you'd give it away free. And in the very earliest days, Bill Gates' view was, don't do that. His view was essentially charge for it. And this was terribly upsetting to the give-it-away-free crowd. And Bill, in fact, published a manifesto of sorts way back when saying, you guys are stealing intellectual property. It took somebody time to make this. It should be paid for. And in the end, his view won. He prevailed. And we all pay for software. It probably would have happened anyway, but he got it to happen very early in the game.
Well, he has cornered a lot of the software market. Would you describe him as a software genius?
He is a business genius. If you read his book, you see again and again his analyses of business situations are right on the mark. He has an exceptional ability, partially because where he sits in the industry, which is right in the middle. He has to deal with people who are making software. He has to deal with people who are making hardware. He sees the whole thing. And he's able to plan his strategies way out. Sometimes they don't work, and sometimes he's saved by an incredible streak of good fortune. But he has an uncanny ability to do this stuff. Technologically, he hires very good people. He does more or less the right things. He picks from the best ideas of others, some of which were not marketed well. But again and again, his company and Bill Gates himself have been able to market other people's good ideas. That's their great virtue.
So you don't consider him a genius at creating software?
Oh, by no means. I mean, the only program he really wrote himself was a program called BASIC, which became Microsoft BASIC, and that was adapted from lots of other versions of BASIC that already existed.
I'd like to talk with you about why he's so controversial within the industry. Let's look first at the current controversy over Windows 95. Now, Windows 95, his new operating system, comes with direct access to Microsoft's own online network, the Microsoft Network. Why is that controversial?
Well, it's controversial because he gets to give it to you for free. When you boot up Windows 95, you have a little icon that says Microsoft Network on it staring you in the face. It's almost impossible to delete it. You can't just say, gee, I don't want to ever look at that again. And all the other competitors, CompuServe, America Online, Prodigy, have to pay for the privilege of being on somebody's computer, and they do. They pay a couple bucks a computer. Sometimes they're paid on the basis of how many people actually sign up. Bill doesn't have to do that. So there was a lot of complaint about this, and it's also true that he gets on every machine that somebody decides to upgrade to Windows 95 since the thing is built in. So it was considered a slightly devious competitive practice.
Now, is it true that if you have Windows 95 and you have that Microsoft Network icon, that you can't easily get on America Online or Prodigy or CompuServe, any of the competing online networks?
No, that's not true. There is one particular technical issue where if you try to get onto the Internet with a few random programs, your program will be knocked out by the way Microsoft Network installs its internet browser. But Prodigy, America Online are all available. That particular thing is not a problem.
Now, the Justice Department has been investigating whether the Microsoft Network is giving Microsoft an unfair advantage. What's the status of that investigation? And tell us more about what this investigation covers.
Well, basically, the issue is, do you get an unfair advantage by automatically giving people access to your system, but not automatically giving access to the others? The Justice Department has been looking at it. They basically got down to a time constraint where they essentially had to let Microsoft know, just for simple fairness, whether they were going to do anything before the release of Windows 95. They chose not to, and the Justice Department says the investigation is continuing. As it turns out, the Microsoft Network has not been what anybody would call a roaring success yet. The focus of the Microsoft Network is about to change, and they will become much more like a standard internet provider, as I think most of the online services will. So it's not at all clear that despite this advantage that they're going to go great guns and wipe out the other systems.
There was an earlier Justice Department investigation of Microsoft. What was that about?
The first involved the way they sold operating systems to hardware manufacturers. And basically the way they did it was to say, count up all the machines you sell and pay us a royalty on each one. And we don't care whether you put Windows or DOS or whatever they happen to be selling on it or not. Now the problem with that was, though it was very nice for Microsoft since they could get an honest count from the vendors, it really effectively kept any competitive product off those machines because they'd already paid for one. And if you've already paid for Microsoft DOS or Microsoft Windows, you're not going to pay for, say, OS 2 and throw that on the machine too. It really was a good way of enforcing a monopoly. And the Justice Department said, in effect, cut that out. You can't do that anymore. And Microsoft agreed. Probably too late to make any difference in the general scheme of things.
And there was another part of the investigation?
Yeah, there was an investigation begun when Microsoft announced it was planning to acquire Intuit, which is a company that makes Quicken, the popular personal finance software. And as that proceeded, Microsoft decided to back out of the deal with Intuit. The issue there was that Microsoft Money, which was a fairly unsuccessful product, and Intuit's Quicken pretty much had a corner of the market, so essentially you were going to roll all the competitors up into one big monopoly, and the government took a dim view of that. Microsoft backed out in part because they didn't want to have to fight it, and in part because the way the deal was structured, it actually got more and more expensive as time went on and they were watching the clock tick.
How did Microsoft become so successful in the operating systems market?
Microsoft has always had a sort of Japanese strategy, which is go out and sell your product cheap at first to get market share, and then slowly raise the ante. And that's what they did with their original product, Microsoft Basic. It became the standard in the early days of personal computing because they sold it incredibly cheaply, usually for a flat fee. Apple probably sold millions of Apple II computers with Microsoft Basic and paid a few thousand bucks for all those copies. Later, they were asked to pay more. The same thing happened with DOS, which was originally on the IBM personal computer. Gates offered them an incredibly good deal, virtually a one-time payment for as many copies as they could sell, and then went around offering people and competitors the same kind of deal. However, the next time around, it got a little more expensive, and that's a strategy that's worked well for them. The same thing pretty much happened with Windows.
Now, some of Microsoft's competitors say that Microsoft is monopolizing the market for operating systems and software. Do you think that's sour grapes? Do you think the other companies just wish they had that business themselves?
Oh, it's a mixed bag. Some of it is sour grapes. Some of it is the fact that, as one of the people we quote in our book says, Microsoft has been the beneficiary of the world's worst competition. I mean, its competitors own the spreadsheet market. They, a different competitor, own the word processing market and manage to watch it be taken away through their own ineptitude. On the other hand, Microsoft does monopolize the operating system market, and there's some element that suggests that that's the way it almost has to be. In other words, you don't want a machine that doesn't run the stuff that you want to run. So by that very nature, you're going to want the machine that has the operating system that's the most popular. And Gates talks about this in his book. He calls it positive feedback loop. People who are less technical might call it the snowball effect. You know, the machine gets to be popular, so more software is developed for it, so more people buy the machine, so more people develop software for it, and on and on.
My guest is Stephen Manis, co-author of the book Gates, about Bill Gates, co-founder and CEO of Microsoft, the computer software giant. Manis is also personal computer columnist for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Manis, co-author of the book Gates, about Bill Gates. Well, let's look at the Apple for a moment. I think with all the marketing blitz for Windows 95, all the attention it's been getting, that some Apple users, for instance, are worried, will Apple become like beta video? In other words, will you reach a point where there's very little that's compatible with it? Is that a rational concern?
Well, it's not a rational concern for the short term. And since these machines tend to become obsolete every 3-4 years or so, you can be reasonably assured if you buy an Apple now, it'll run everything you've got and a bunch of new things, at least in that time frame. But Apple's always been this sort of 10% solution. It's always been a computer for people who wanted a different kind of computer. And it isn't getting some of the top development, for example, in games. It's not getting the absolute state-of-the-art game development. But on the other hand, it still has quite a bit of software being made for it every day, and many of the titles that run on Windows 95 are developed with Macintoshes, which the developers just like better. Apple also, in the last quarter, apparently sold more computers than any single manufacturer. Of course, if you add up all the manufacturers of Windows-based computers, that number doesn't look as good. But Apple's biggest problem right now is making all the computers it has demand for.
Now, Apple and Microsoft have become competitors because of their different operating systems, but Apple and Microsoft collaborated early on, didn't they?
And they still do. It's a very strange aspect. And they did while Apple was suing Microsoft for what they claimed, what Apple claimed, was in essence stealing the Macintosh operating system and turning it into Windows. And certainly stealing the look and feel of it, a case that they lost. But all during that period, Microsoft was actually making more money per Macintosh sold than they were per DOS machine sold. And the reason was that Apple and Microsoft cut a deal very early on that gave Microsoft a head start on developing applications. Again, the word processor, Word, the spreadsheet, Excel. And virtually every Mac that goes out the door is going to use one or the other of those apps. So it's Microsoft makes money on every Macintosh sold to this day.
So are Apple and Microsoft on good terms or bad terms now? Or a little bit of both?
Or probably a little bit of both. Yeah, I mean, Microsoft is still making Macintosh products. Apple is still making products that run on Windows. There's a product called QuickTime for Windows that's used in a lot of multimedia programs that take something that was on the Mac and brings it over to Windows. It's a strange business. The alliances and partnerships and joint ventures always startle you because strange bedfellows are made. IBM and Apple have gotten together in another industry alliance. You never know. And a lot of times people are competing and beating their brains out on one side, and the other side they're cooperating and putting together deals.
What are some of the other concerns about the size and power of Microsoft now?
Well, one concern that hasn't been voiced that much is simply that they're becoming like General Motors in, say, 1970, where they're making sort of big, boring products, and there's no Toyota around or Volkswagen around to give them any competition. So they can essentially get away with products that are kind of slow, big, clunky, and improve them only marginally because, hey, you know, you want anything else, there's nothing really any better out there. So the question is, you know, how fast can they move? on that kind of stuff, and how fast do they have to. The thing that's made them wake up is the Internet, because they were slow, as in fact most people were, to catch on to the fact that the Internet was going to be a big thing. And they're reinventing their strategy. This is a company that historically has reinvented itself again and again and done it successfully. They started out as a company making computer languages, something that only the techiest of techies would be interested in. They switched to making application software, word processors, that kind of stuff, fairly early on. And then kind of through the back door got forced into making operating systems, which really turned out to be their cash cow. But they've changed beyond that. They've gotten bigger in applications. So now the company does all kinds of things. They also make encyclopedias on CD-ROM. Gates has had an extraordinary ability to change his company when he saw it was necessary. And what he says in the book is that no company has really succeeded in two major phases of the information revolution. IBM was great in the mainframe days. Now its glory days are behind it. Gates intends to see that doesn't happen to his company.
Well, as you point out in your book about Bill Gates, he's the only one of the wunderkind who got started early on in their careers in the computer industry who still controls the company, the first company that they started.
Yeah, absolutely. Partially because he never took venture capital financing, partly because he is extremely good at deal making. I mean, he managed to make sure that he was the majority partner when he had one other partner, Paul Allen, working with him. Paul Allen is also a billionaire, but not quite on the class of Bill Gates. Gates has been extraordinarily good at running that company. And as I say, the business genius is clear.
My guest is Stephen Manis, co-author of the book Gates, about Bill Gates, co-founder and CEO of Microsoft, the computer software giant. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stephen Manis, co-author of the book Gates, about Bill Gates. Manis is also a personal computer columnist for the New York Times. Let's get back to the Internet. I think a lot of people saw the Internet as an almost utopian place in cyberspace, where information was free and it was easy to get online once you had the right equipment for it. And, you could start a homepage really easily. And now everybody wants to know, well, how can I make a buck off the Internet? Do you think that there are two really competing visions of the Internet right now that are vying for the future of the net?
Well, the whole problem with the net is that most of the people who are on it so far are not directly paying for it. It's just like, radio or television over the air. You know, it comes in and you're not paying for it. The difference was, until now, there were no ads. It was just kind of done altruistically. Again, it's this model of the hacker giving away his valuable information, the academic making sure that his information is widely disseminated, the wacky guy with the homepage who just has a kind of vanity interest in seeing who comes by and stops by. Now we're getting to the point where people have bodies of information that have cost them some money to acquire, newspapers, magazines, encyclopedias, whatever you want to do. Some of this information isn't free. You just can't give it away because it costs you a lot of money to do it, put it together. Now the question is, how do you get people to pay for this stuff over a medium where they've never been paying for it? And it's a tough call. Right now the model seems to be television. It seems to be advertising. So people won't pay for it. The advertisers will pay for it. But for a lot of things, that's just not going to work well. I mean, if you want to search for a particular newspaper article, do you really want to look at an ad? And the answer may be no. You might be willing to pay not to look at an ad. And as Gates points out in his book, and I think he's absolutely right, the modes of getting paid for stuff are going to be crucial to where the Internet goes and how the Internet and its successors look. I mean, it's just not clear. And most of the studies show that people don't like paying for this stuff. They look at it, there's a novelty element, and then they go back to TV or radio or CDs or whatever they like to do. As soon as you introduce a fairly substantial payment into the mix, people say, well, I think I'll do something else.
What are some of your frustrations with the Internet?
Frustration with all computer stuff, and one of the things that Gates just doesn't pay much attention to, is that the software is genuinely lousy. It crashes a lot. The Internet connections on the Internet, you have a basic problem that connections are hard to make. Sometimes you can get busy signals for 5-10 minutes on some systems, the ones I use. Sometimes there's in effect a busy signal at the other end where so many people are trying to get into a popular website. Most recently, Showgirls was one. People seem to have a great need to take a look at the pictures from Showgirls, and it would take you just forever to get the information down. It's kind of traffic jams on the information highway. The problem with the Internet, the real problem with the Internet is basically the same as with all other media, and it's a question of human creativity. How many great movies do you actually see? How many great books do you actually read? And on the net, and that's from professionals who are trying to sell you stuff and presumably maintain some sort of professional standard. On the net, it's a world of amateurs, and people can say anything, whether it's true or not, make up the most outrageous stuff. And a lot of it's just plain boring. You really get a sense of amateurishness, and that's understandable. Now, if you look at your local cable access station, where presumably by now people should be getting it, you generally tend to flip away from it pretty quickly because it's just amateur night in Dixie. You really have this problem on the net of just a huge vessel filled with a lot of junk.
Don't you think the opposite problem is true, too, that the pros are taking over? A lot of the home pages that I access end up being nothing but press releases, really.
Oh, absolutely. But again, it's the same problem of human creativity. The corporations don't have any more purchase on it than anybody else. One of the problems I have with Bill Gates' glorious vision of education suddenly magically getting better and our lives magically getting better is that the problem isn't dissemination. We don't have a great problem of disseminating information here. We have a great problem in creating wonderful stuff that we really want to spend time with, that's really thoughtful. That's the bottleneck. The human bottleneck is always the case. These technologists are incredibly good at solving narrowly focused problems. Make the computer faster, make the computer smaller, make the computer put pictures on the screen. It's kind of like the go-to-the-moon argument. If we send a man to the moon, a very limited technological feat, how come we can't do X? Well, X is messy. X is human. X requires a whole bunch of competing demands to be resolved, and you can't necessarily get that automatically. You just don't magically get better anything because of technology.
When Windows 95 was first marketed in the late summer, there was a huge advertising and marketing campaign, but as Bill Gates said when I spoke with him, perhaps the most attention they got was because of press coverage. He said they were just totally unprepared for the amount of coverage that TV and newspapers, and I guess he meant radio too, gave to Windows 95. As a computer person within the press, what do you think? Do you think that the press hyped Windows 95?
Microsoft has always worked the press in brilliant ways. They spent a fortune on public relations. For years, they spent probably more on public relations than they did on advertising. They really like to deal with the press. They do it exceptionally well. And Bill's public image is designed to capture attention whenever they want it. There's probably no other CEO who can make himself available, and suddenly, everybody wants to see the guy. I mean, if you take, say, Larry Ellison of Oracle, who's another software billionaire, nobody's ever heard of him, in part because he works in a different kind of business, but in part because he's not been promoted to the masses as boy genius, great expert. And the same thing happened with Windows 95. The buzz was carefully controlled. the press played into the hands of Microsoft. And basically, it was an astounding performance for what's essentially an upgrade product. This is not all new. It's not, you know, say a quantum leap the way the Macintosh was from its predecessors. It's just kind of an improvement, and they got away with it.
Well, Stephen Manos, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It was fun.
Stephen Manos is the co-author of the book Gates, about Bill Gates. Manos is a personal computer columnist for the New York Times.